We have Mr. Hayden and Mr. Anderson. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Hans.
All right, Mr. Hayden, whenever you're ready.
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay, so give our timer a second. 5 minutes for rebuttal. Okay, great. You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Charles Hayden. I represent Chavis Dante Holloman, who was convicted in a jury trial in the Hampton Circuit Court on 8 felony counts, including a murder count, for which he received a sentence of life plus 63 years in prison. He's assigned as error in this case. Among the assignments of error is that there was what we would submit was a transactional immunity agreement that was drafted by the Commonwealth that Mr. Holloman did not breach but fulfilled the terms of. He was required under the terms of the agreement to undergo a debriefing with the Commonwealth, which he did. And if he was called upon to testify, he would have to cooperate with the Commonwealth. He was never called upon to testify, and therefore he was entitled to specific performance under the agreement. The agreement stated that the first sentence of the cooperation immunity agreement provided in pertinent part as follows, quote, "The Hampton Commonwealth Attorney's Office agrees not to prosecute you for any violation of the criminal laws of the Commonwealth based on statements provided pursuant to this agreement," unquote. And so this is governed by contract law. It's also, there's not only contract law, there's the due process concerns of the cases outside of it. Say when a criminal defendant enters into an agreement, he's entitled to specific performance on the agreement and the absence of some proof that he has breached the agreement. And so in this case, the judge turns, when the motion to dismiss the charges are made, the judge declines the request and characterizes this agreement as a use immunity agreement.
Didn't the agreement specifically refer to it as use immunity?
There was a term, use immunity, used, but the wording of the agreement of what the Commonwealth is obligated to do was stated in that first sentence.
But that sentence is qualified when it says that the Commonwealth Attorney's Office agrees not to prosecute for violations of the criminal law based on statements provided pursuant to this agreement. He was not prosecuted based on any statements provided pursuant to the agreement, was he?
I would submit that clearly the substance of their debriefing covered statements concerning these very offenses for which the Commonwealth proceeds to prosecute him on. What was his benefit if it wasn't what was provided for in the agreement? The Commonwealth, if they've already got their case, they can proceed to prosecute. What do they need to debrief him for? But he agrees to talk with them with this promise that they've made of dismissing all charges, not to prosecute him.
Counsel, in fairness, we don't know what other information he may have provided about other crimes by other individuals.
Right.
Based on the debriefing.
That's correct. I would respectfully submit that the case law that I've cited says that courts do not have the authority to rewrite contractual agreements. That's not within the province of the court. Its responsibility is to enforce the agreements, and especially in the context of a criminal case, and agreement of this sort carries with it due process safeguards that require its enforcement. Beyond that, I'd like to move on, touch on the other assignments of error. There was the There were 8 charges. 3 of them pertained to one date in September. 5 of them pertained to a separate date, separate location, approximately 2 months before. And we submit that there was clearly a need to separate out these two. He did, should not have been having to try all these matters at once. I would note that I would respectfully disagree with a certain factual assertion in the AG's brief that on page 18 the AG writes, quote, "The Commonwealth also put on evidence that a separate crime occurred at 101 West Pembroke was at the same apartment complex where Needham was killed." That's the Needham is the July incident, and this apartment at West Pembroke is not the same location. I respectfully submit that it's just factually wrong. The two incidents occurred in entirely different neighborhoods. The Needham shooting occurred at the Hampton Creek Apartments on East Pembroke Avenue in the Buck Row section.
Forgetting about the site's location and such, which I think got overblown in the Scott decision because it was fact specific. But Scott clearly says that that offenses are part of a common plan when they are related to one another for the purpose of accomplishing a particular goal. Wasn't there evidence here that both of these offenses were designed to accomplish the goal of enhancing the prestige, the reputation of the gang?
That was suggested, but it was
wasn't one of the charges criminal gang violence?
There was a charge of gang participation. That's correct.
And doesn't that require that the crime be in furtherance of the objectives of the gang?
Yes, and that's correct. I would respectfully submit it's entirely speculative from the evidence that was in the record whether the shooting incident involving the September incident with Ms. Rhonda Stubbs, whether that was part of a common scheme or plan, or it's purely conjectural.
Was that one of the other predicate crimes of violence that the Commonwealth used to support its gang participation indictment?
I'm sorry, I don't recollect whether it was or not.
Could it have been?
It might have been. Might have been, but I'm not sure. I'm sorry, I don't have the answer to that. I just wanted to note that the Stubbs shooting occurred in the Harbor Square Old Town Apartments on West Pembroke near the courts in downtown Hampton. The other incident occurs miles away on East Pembroke, which is in the Buck Row section of Hampton, quite a distance away. There's no suggestion that there was any kind of locational nexus involved here. I'd also like to touch on the issue of the motion to strike for calls the prospective juror Mr. James Frontier.
Are you suggesting that his prior employment is a per se disqualification?
Not per se. No, it isn't. But certainly this was a case.
Per se in a criminal case.
Yeah, it's not per se in a criminal case, but the specific facts of this situation was that this was a longtime employee of the Hampton Police Department, retired officer from the Hampton Police Department, who was being asked to consider evidence concerning the investigations of the Hampton Police Department regarding, and the 3 of the witnesses were longtime detectives of the Hampton Police Department that he surely knew, and also a longtime witness who was a longtime former Hampton prosecutor that he acknowledged in the voir dire that he knew, Mr. David Holt. So there when you have this kind of close connection with these very investigators, these very witnesses, and this very same police department, and he's being asked to, the defense is required to use one of its peremptory strikes to finally get rid of this person.
Did the jurors say anything that could be perceived as bias? I mean, was there anything that was brought out in voir dire that you could point to suggest that he could not be fair and impartial?
He did not specifically give I can't point to a bad answer on his part, aside from the fact that the longtime close affiliation with the Hampton Police Department, the very persons that it seems to me that in this case the court had a responsibility where there was a reasonable question about the impartiality of that juror. Those borderline kind of cases, the court has a responsibility to rule in favor of the defendant in that sort of situation. I've cited the cases that support that proposition. I don't think it's necessary to say anything else about it. I would note another assignment of error pertains to the jury instruction about co-conspirator testimony and the unreliability of it, how the jury needs to be wary of co-conspirator testimony. The defense sought an instruction warning to warn the jurors about that issue, and that request was denied. And of course, the standard is if these persons, these witnesses, could have been indicted for the same offenses that the defendant was, well, the instruction is warranted. And of course, the Virginia Supreme Court just last year set aside a defendant who had 128 year sentence for precisely this error of not warning the jurors. It's a long, at least 100 year precedent in this Commonwealth that this is a dangerous situation when you have co-conspirators, persons who have an obvious motive to lie, to set it off on the other persons, absolve themselves of blame. They needed to be warned about that, and they weren't in this case. I would respectfully submit that's another reason to set aside these convictions. If there are no other questions, I'll just reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Anderson. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. On the immunity agreement, Judge Petty has referred to several things I wanted to bring up. First, the second, obviously an agreement, whether you're looking at it as a contractual matter or just otherwise, you have to look at it in toto. The second sentence of this agreement, which is at page 18 of the appendix, says this use immunity applies to any conversations happening police, blah, blah, blah.
Did the Commonwealth draft this agreement?
Presumably. I don't know if there's anything in the record specifically confirming that, but I would certainly think the answer is yes, because it was sent on April 28, 2011 by the senior assistant Commonwealth attorney. So in the absence of any indication that there had been some prior...
Don't we interpret ambiguities in a contract against the drafter of that contract?
As a general proposition, that's correct. I think the second sentence removes any claimed ambiguity. I mean, it says use immunity without qualification. Also, just as a matter of English, I think the argument is not well taken. And again, Your Honor's question about referring to the fact that he wasn't prosecuted for any statement he made pursuant to the agreement, which is clearly correct. I mean, the Commonwealth attorney at two separate pretrial hearings on this motion said categorically and repeatedly that the prosecutions were not based on anything he said in this so-called debriefing.
What impact does the trial court's ruling that the Commonwealth could use anything he said as a result of the agreement to impeach him if he were to testify differently. Isn't that effectively a use or potential use of his testimony that apparently in this case kept him from testifying?
Well, there's never been any assertion, first of all, either at trial or, to the best of my recollection, on brief, that but for this agreement he would have testified. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I still think you have to take the agreement as it was recited. For example, if you had truly had some transactional immunity agreement, the agreement, which the court aptly pointed out, was the language was probably less than felicitous. But for example, if you truly wanted to give transactional immunity, it'd be very easy to do it. You could say something like, in exchange for your coming to the Commonwealth Attorney's Office to discuss truthfully these matters, we're not going to prosecute you for these offenses. You could have said something like that. This is far removed from that. Basically, there are two different ways you could construe it. You could say, based on these statements, we're not going to prosecute you. Or, we're not going to prosecute you as to these statements. I think it's plainly the latter that the parties contemplated. I mean, even just as a matter of English, if the very first sentence, Hampton office agrees not to prosecute you for any violation of the criminal laws of the Commonwealth of Virginia, if you had a comma there based on, it would be, just as a matter of English, it would be a more reasonable assertion that this is the rationale for why we're not going to prosecute you. You have no comma. You have the statement that was given, and then it's followed up immediately with a reference to use immunity. It also,
Mr. Anderson, I wonder if I could, I don't mean to interrupt you, but the time runs quickly in these cases. There is one assignment of error that I would like to ask you about particularly. That's the assignment of error challenging the gang expert's testimony based on the gang notebook. The law is pretty clear that under 801-401.1 that an expert in a criminal case can only testify based on facts and evidence and hypotheticals. Here, however, the expert testified from this document that was never introduced in evidence and apparently reached this conclusion partly as a result of that. Doesn't that cause a problem in terms of what we have here?
Well, I think first of all, the expert. Let me double check one thing here about the assignments of error and how they were couched. The fourth assignment of error, first of all, doesn't challenge as such the expert testimony of this detective Sales. So that's the first thing I would point out. It references solely, talks about the introduction of this exhibit, and your honors indicated it was not introduced. And I went over myself and reviewed the file and reviewed pretty closely the trial transcripts, and as best I can tell, it was never introduced.
Well, counsel, that's something. Answer Judge Petty's question, but we want to get back to that issue, whether the notebook was introduced.
I don't think it was. The Commonwealth Attorney's brief in opposition said specifically it was not.
The assignment challenges Detective Sales' testimony that the notebook asserted that Holman was a general in the Trey 9 Trey gang. Doesn't that challenge the expert testimony of the gang expert?
Well, first of all, this individual testifies an expert in large measure because he was very familiar with gangs nationally and this particular gang locally. So he had a lot of knowledge that he brought to the subject.
Was any of that knowledge in evidence? That seems to be the problem I'm having. He did a lot of talking, but none of it was based on any evidence that was before the court.
Well, there was tons of evidence that the defendant was the so-called five-star general of this group who called the shots, no pun intended, as to their potential criminal activities. There were numerous witnesses that said that. There were witnesses also referred to the so-called Dino, who's the four-star general in charge of punishments. There was very little. And Manning, LaToya Manning, was a prosecution witness. She acknowledged she was a member of the gang. And by the way, her testimony is very important in this. There was substantial evidence about the notebook that was never objected to. LaToya Manning, during her direct examination, the matter of this gang notebook came up, and she, in so many words, said that the gang members used it. It had gang history information in there. It had stuff about potential punishments for gang transgressions, insufficient knowledge of gang history.
What was the actual opinion that was related by this gang expert?
His expert testimony was at the very end of his testimony. I think I can find this fairly quickly, I hope. He gave an expert account, offered the expert opinion that he had been a member of the gang. That's not his exact words. No, I have it in here.
Did he say, in my opinion, that there is a gang called the Nine Tray Gang, and in my opinion, this defendant is a member of that gang?
My recollection is he said something along those lines, and I know it's near the end of his testimony. It's a little frustrating. I can't lay my hands on it.
If that's the case, isn't that opinion to some extent derived from the information he got from this gang notebook?
I'm not sure how much derived from the notebook versus what he knew as a longtime Hampton police officer who dealt with these gangs. And I would say this, he certainly, based on the other evidence that came to light from Manning, for example, another police officer said the notebook was found near one of the co-defendants. He said nothing that the evidence did not overwhelmingly and basically, in an uncontradicted manner, showed. So he certainly didn't make life more difficult for the defendant. And another way of putting it is, if somehow anything he said was error, I think it is patently harmless, given the other evidence which unambiguously showed that there was a gang operating in Hampton. Holloman was a member of it, and not only a member, but was the top dog. He was the five-star general.
Counsel, direct your attention to the appendix 640 to 642, where it appears that the notebook was admitted into evidence, because Ms. Todd says, and then this one, Judge, is the gang notebook. The court says, all right, that's what number? It's number 16. Mr. Hobbs says, I object to that. I think that I'm going to renew the objections. And then the court, a little bit farther down, says he's objecting to the book. And then they go into a discussion about the book. And then the court ultimately says, okay, again, I overrule your objection. I think it's an issue for the jury. And then the actual log for the evidence says that number 16 notebook was admitted, and that the original was returned to the Commonwealth.
Well, I would certainly be the first to say that I cannot say with categorical assurance it was not introduced. I will say that those pages are in the context of the defense renewing its prior objections. I will also say that whether the notebook was introduced as such, my argument by no means rises and falls with whether it was introduced or not, because The fact is that the jury learned little, if anything, of anything in inculpating the defendant, that the evidence throughout this trial did not otherwise overwhelmingly establish. There's no challenge, for example, to the defendant's statements to the police immediately after his arrest. There was no real challenge to the repeated descriptions about this gang operating there and that he was S-Dot, the five-star general. If there had been, that'd be different. The expert, to me, when you read it, it's almost more of an informational thing about the gang culture, which I would say is an oxymoron, but be that as it may, I'm not really sure, other than it was interesting educational information about the operating of gangs. I don't really see how the jury heard that and said, well, we weren't really sure before if there was a gang and he was an intimate member of it, but this really tears it there. I don't think there's anything remotely like that.
What about for purposes of punishment? I mean, this really aggravated things for the defendant in terms of the kind of group he's affiliated with. It's a national gang that goes around and breaks the law constantly.
Well, I think at least one or two of the prosecution witnesses said in so many words it was part of the national bloods. Again, I think what was damaging to him as to the sentence is just the sheer inhumanity and brutality and mindlessness of these repeated actions, not anything this particular detective said about a gang notebook. I mean, the defense attorney himself even pointed out, I think it was the Commonwealth attorney pointed out, there wasn't even a specific reference to the name of Holloman in there. There were a lot of references to S-Dot by defense counsel, but there were a lot of references to him being S-Dot throughout the trial.
Counsel, I see you're running low on time. Can you address joinder, the joinder issue?
I'd say it's either or both of two things. One, and first of all, counsel said that these crimes occurred about 2 months apart. They actually occurred less than a month apart. I certainly would assume counsel's knowledge of geography in Hampton is at least equal to mine. I went through it. I have what I have in the brief, and if it's wrong, it's wrong. But I would submit that it was, in fact, a common plan. The first one, plainly, was grade A example of what these groups do. I mean, they were looking for an easy robbery, and that led to the would-be robbery and the killing of Thomas Needham. The second one, about 4 weeks later, was just apparently part of some ongoing turf war. And finally, I'd say, totally apart from that, it was proper under Section 18.2-46.1. You had gang participation as one of the offenses. And per the Russian case, which is still good law as to this, you have to show, in order to show a violation of the statute, two or more predicate criminal acts, at least one of which involved a violent act, and also the definition of a criminal street gang in 46.1 includes references to two or more predicate criminal acts, at least one of which is an act of violence, provided such acts were not part of a common act or transaction. So by the defendant's own argument, severance was not appropriate under that language I've just quoted.
All right. The counsel, under that language you just quoted, then the two things are mutually exclusive. The court would either have to find a common scheme or plan or that it was being admitted to.
I think that may be right, although from my viewpoint, as long as it finds one or the other as a basis for upholding the... We make alternative arguments all the time, and I think under either of these theories, one or the other of these theories supports the trial court's denial of the suppression of the severance ruling. Just one last thing. I know I'm out of time. I will point out on your Honor's question, the statute says, provided they were not part of a common act or transaction, and that's from what the Supreme Court has said in these other cases, the common plan may be distinct from that language. So
Thank you, counsel.
In any event, I would ask the court to uphold that ruling based on either of those grounds.
Thank you. All right. The next case.
No, we're
done. Oh, I'm sorry. Pardon me. Sorry, Mr. Hayden.
Mr. Hayden, I'd like to ask you real quick on the issue about the gang notebook. In your brief on that, you remark that it is undoubtedly the case that the gang notebook was testimonial in nature, and this addresses your Sixth Amendment argument. But the Supreme Court has held that testimonial statements are those that were made under circumstances which would lead an objective witness reasonably to believe that the statement would be available for use at a later trial. Does that gang notebook meet that test? Was that prepared so that it would be available for use at a later trial?
Well, the detective testifies that in the gang notebook he's described as being S-Dot, the defendant, and that he's described in the notebook as being a five-star general. So this is an assertion.
Was that included in the notebook for purposes of later prosecution? Because I'm kind of thinking it probably wasn't.
I don't quite understand the nuance of the question.
In order for it to be testimonial, it has to be prepared under circumstances which would lead an objective witness to reasonably believe the statement would be available for use at a later trial. And I'm having a hard time understanding how the gang, when they sat down and prepared this gang notebook, had any conceivable notion that they were doing so for purposes of a future prosecution.
I see. Well, I suppose certainly we don't know any information about who exactly prepared this notebook. That was a strange thing. I couldn't understand how it was coming in at all when it has no connection with the defendant in terms of it's not written by him. It wasn't in his possession. It was just this notebook that makes factual assertions about the defendant that is just sort of in the air, these assertions with completely that the detective proceeds to repeat the assertions in his testimony as an expert based on what he's seen in the gang notebook. And I would submit that it was properly objected to that the detective acknowledged he didn't know when the notebook was written. He didn't know. He acknowledged it wasn't written by Chavis Holloman. Didn't belong to Chavis Holloman. Wasn't found in his possession. One final thing regarding the question of who drafted the agreement. There was representations made in the argument about enforcement of the agreement on page 90. Of the appendix, defense attorney asserts that Commonwealth drafted this in terms, as I read in the first sentence, is a blanket immunity. That's on page 9. That's asserted. Also on page 87, the prosecutor notes that what I've highlighted in my motion is based on what they've given them, the terms that they drafted and put into their agreement. And these are the assertions being made by the defense counsel, not disputed at all. But it was drafted, in fact, by the Commonwealth purely.
Thank you, counsel.